This is Ink Sense on CITR 101.9 FM. My guest for this interview is Durf, author of Punk Rock in Trailer Parks, as well as an assortment of other books, including High School with Dahmer, or My Life with Dahmer.
My Friend Dahmer.
My Friend Dahmer. Did you actually go to high school with him?
Yes, I did.
Okay. We'll get into that a little later.
Everybody does.
What can you, you know, it's a curious subject.
Well, it's my brush with greatness. That's okay.
If you want to call it that. Maybe we'll use another term. Punk Rock Trailer Parks, I guess it's a bit of a love song of a comic to the early days of Americana punk rock. Is that a good way of putting it?
Well, yeah, pretty gritty love song. I mean, I'm not
punk rock.
I'm not known as a sentimentalist, so. But yeah, it's a fictional piece. First of all, it's not nonfiction, and it's sort of a Rust Belt ode to punk rock.
Well, I felt a little sentimental because it seems all the people you feature in it have all passed away.
Oh, well, yeah. There's a number of guest stars that come through the book, for those of you who haven't read it, like Joe Strummer and Wendy O. Williams of the Plasmatics and Lester Bangs. And it actually didn't start out that way. I was like halfway through writing it, and I noticed that all the people I was putting in to the book, who were people that were my personal favorites, that were all gone. And after that, I just decided, well, I'll just make them all dead. So I only used after that, I only used ones who had passed away, and it wasn't hard to come up with it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Either that means we're, you know, I'm getting old, or it was a pretty tough lifestyle. I suspect it's a little of both.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the latter. You know.
Right.
These folks died of, you know, various rough illnesses. It wasn't like...
Well, except Wendy. She offed herself. And
well, that's a rough way to...
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, you can also argue heroin addiction and whatnot, too.
Right, sure.
How did you first get into Yule punk rock?
Well, I was a first generation punk rocker. So, I mean, you know, I was a kid. I was just right out of high school, but I took to it right away, you know, for the usual reasons, you know. It was my first foray into the counterculture, and it was a blast. And so I've always, even though my musical tastes since then have, you know, expanded greatly, I still have a soft spot for stuff that's loud and raw.
Beyond the initial three chords.
Right, sure. Yeah, it has expanded beyond that. And, you know, it's a fascinating time, and it's something that hasn't really been touched on a lot, especially in comics.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, where I set the book, which is the unlikely city of Akron, Ohio, the Rubber City, yeah, which at the time had a huge punk rock scene, which has now been largely forgotten. But it was, you know, Devo and Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders and the Waitresses and so many other bands that Melody Maker magazine actually called Akron the New Liverpool in 1979, which is ridiculous to think of now, but at the time it was huge. And it all revolved around this one punk club, which is one of the most famous punk clubs ever, called The Bank, which was just that. It was an old abandoned bank. I mean, it still had the vault in the middle of it and, you know, all the trappings of an old bank, and it was converted into a punk club.
Instead of the normal old blues bars.
Right. No. This was complete. It was great. It was a great setting for what was going on with punk, you know, that whole nihilism thing, that whole, you know, it's the end of the American dream. And it was, of course, in the Rust Belt, because the factories were closing and everybody was splitting and, you know, pretty much where we are now. And so it was a great setting for this sort of, you know, this caterwaul that was coming out of this club.
Mm-hmm. What was the first punk record that really blew your mind?
The first one is probably the Ramones' first album, just like anybody else. Though I didn't hear it when it first came out, it was shortly after. And I was really into the stiff stuff, too, you know, stiff records. They put out a lot of the early bands like the Pogues and Elvis Costello and Devo.
Mm-hmm.
It was great stuff.
Have you heard Devo 2.0?
Well, they were just in town. I'd heard them then.
The 2.0 one?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the 2.0. No, I haven't heard Devo 2.0.
It's this poppy cover band that,
Mark
Brothers Bow approved of and helped put together, I think, or helped produce, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's like teenagers.
Yeah,
doing.
No, the original was fine. Beyond that, you know.
I know there was there's a couple of shows that I've heard that people have gone to. Recent Devo, I think, where they were blown away.
Right, no, yeah, so. They were just in town. And I mean they're very large now, but they still put on a great show.
Not wearing the costumes
do wear the costumes actually. They still have the energy domes and the white suit and the yellow suits, all in XXL.
When I saw Kraftwerk a couple of years ago, and that's kind of a similar thing. All these old German guys with these.
Well, yeah, they're German. So, well, of course, most of, you know, the guys from Devo are all Middle Europeans from Akron too. Same gene pool. It doesn't hold up well.
Now, in how do you, writers include themselves in their works, and what kind of characters in punk rock and trailer parks do you see kind of yourself in?
No, well, this is an exception because I did not put myself in punk rock and trailer parks purposely, because my first two books, were both memoir. Mm-hmm. So I was in the first two books. And when I approached this one, I was determined it was going to be fiction. And it was not going to be about me. It was not going to be about my life. So, I mean, my protagonist is named Otto, who's this larger-than-life figure, and he's, you know, the exact opposite of me. I mean, he's an extrovert. He's fearless. He seizes the moment. And that was by design.
Mm-hmm. Did you know anyone like the Baron back in the day?
Well, I think everybody knows somebody like the Baron, but he's a fairly unique individual. And that's where I started with the book. I started with that character. I'd come up with that character. Because when I was thinking about, you know, what to write about, the geek is, you know, sort of the staple of comics and certainly the staple of indie comics. And it's kind of tiresome, especially this sort of, you know, self-hating, wretched individual, woe is me, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do something like that. But what I hadn't seen was someone I run into quite a bit I just call him the narcissistic geek, you know, the guy who thinks he's a rock star, who thinks he's a god. And these are the guys who are running the world now, for better or worse, and right now it's for worse. You know, the Bill Gates types and things like that. So that's where I started.
He definitely has that the proud inner geekisms, especially with the oft-quoted Tolkien.
Right.
It definitely gives me that feeling of right in the 70s, No. Would he have played Dungeons and Dragons, or is that too early?
I think it's a little early,
Early.
Yeah, there were probably a few out, but that was the front end of it. I don't remember that being on my radar screen.
Maybe it's for the
Thank
better.
God. As if I wasn't dork enough for being a comics nut.
What kind of comics did you read as a youngin?
Well, I mean, you started out with superhero stuff like everybody else, and then somewhere around the mid-70s, I got my mitts on some underground stuff. And, you know, the things that were being done in National Lampoon, that was all great. Those were some great comics in there.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like the reference to National Lampoon in the book.
Right.
The guaranteed certain amount of breasts per
exactly,
per issue.
Exactly. Well, yeah, you know, horny young teenagers before the internet had it tougher than, you know, kids now. And you can just type in boobs and you've got, you know,
boobs.
50,000 Google hits.
I was trying to explain in a class the other day to some fellow students. I'm a couple of years older than most of the other people in class, and they're talking about how, you know, the internet, has it really changed anything? I'm like, you know, I remember the day when I had these German guys come and stay with me, and they gave me this tape of this awesome German band, and I loved it, and I had to track down more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was hard because someone knew a little bit of it, and you kind of gathered what you could, and now you can just download the whole discography.
Right.
And I'm like, you know?
It's made it a lot easier to find stuff. It's just made it a lot harder to actually make a living at it.
Yeah, for everyone.
Right, because everything's free.
Except for the tours, I guess. So you got into undergrounds.
Right.
Who were some of your underground interests?
Well, Crumb, of course.
Yeah.
Von Baudet. I always liked Bill Griffith and Spain Rodriguez. And then later on, you know,
Spain's from Cleveland, isn't he?
Who?
Spain, he's from Cleveland, I think.
No.
Oh, where is he?
No, he's from California. Crumb lived here for a while.
No, Spain's
but he
originally
hated it.
from the East Coast.
Who?
Spain.
Crumb? Crumb was from Philly, I think.
No, but Spain's from the East Coast originally.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Probably New York.
I'm trying to remember. I can't remember.
I don't know. I'm not up on my trivia.
That's okay.
You're the expert. What were we talking about? Oh, undergrounds. And then some of the post-punk guys, the full-blown punk guys, like John Holmstrom, who was the art director of Punk Magazine, and Mark Merrick and guys like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lost interest. Right about the time I really got into music, I lost interest in comics for a while.
What, did you, like, do something else before going and doing comics and doing a comic strip? Or, like...
Well, I started out life as a political cartoonist.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, like one of the mainstream though I was never really very mainstream. As you can imagine, it didn't work out very well. In fact, I was fired for, as the editor put it, general tastelessness.
Well, it doesn't take much to offend people.
Well, I have a particular gift for it too. And then I wandered off to the weekly press, you know, the weekly papers that you used to see stacked up in front of coffee shops all over any major big city.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started my strip, which is called The City. And that's been going on for like 19 years.
Wow. I haven't read The City. Tell me about it.
Well, it's just that. I mean, it's a weekly strip about being a urban hipster and, you know, everything that revolves around that. So it's kind of free form. It's, you know, there's some politics in there. It's whatever pops into my head. And it runs in weekly papers all over, so they're fading fast.
Any particular places people could check it out?
If
they still read.
Right, right. Cleveland, Dallas, Houston, Miami, Tucson, Kansas City, on and on and on. Cincinnati.
So fair distribution.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, newspapers are on the rocks, so it's fading fast.
Mm-hmm. When did you decide to go into doing more longer comics like the Punk Rock and Trailer Parks and the
Well, I've always had an interest in it. You know, I just never had a lot of time, and I was making a decent living doing the strip. And I think it was the first piece I did was My Friend Dahmer. And I started working on that in the mid-90s. And I found it a lot harder than I thought it would be to sort of cross over, you know. Comic books are a very incestuous little world, and it seems like you got to be part of the club, or they're, you know, there are people who are really just won't let you in. It was really kind of bizarre, considering that, you know, 90% of comic books are absolute crap, and, you know, I'm certainly capable of doing crap like anybody else, so why not give me a chance? But with Dahmer, I actually had to publish Dahmer myself.
Really?
And it was nominated for an Eisner, so that's kind of opened the door.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, I wasn't very familiar with your work until you contacted me.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed Punk Rock and Trailer Park.
Oh, thanks.
I checked out the site and saw the Dahmer thing, and I read the pages that were on there, and I was like, this is fantastic.
Yeah, that was that's actually being redone. I have an offer to do that as a full-blown graphic novel.
Really?
And I'm probably going to do it because, you know, it's such a compelling story.
It is. It was fascinating. I was really interested because it's... From the pages I was reading, it wasn't like you were trying to kind of place a judgment as much as going, this is the guy I went to high school with.
Right.
This is...
It's actually a fairly sympathetic portrait of him.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people have trouble getting their heads around. But I think that's the point of the book, is that, you know, when you make somebody a monster, that's an easy out.
Yeah. And, but what made the monster?
Right.
The
There's a reason people become, and maybe you can't figure it out, but in Dahmer's case, at every point in his spiral into madness, which was fairly quick over the course of maybe 3 years of high school, the adults in his life failed him. And they either didn't notice what was going on, or they convinced themselves there was nothing wrong. And, you know, it was just every single one, teachers, administrators, parents, whoever. And that's the lesson that, you know, I think is there. And it's a very dark story, obviously. It's nothing like Punk Rock and Trailer Parks or anything else I do. But it's a good story, and it's gotten a lot of attention. So I really would like the opportunity to do it right. As I said, because it was self-published, that, you know, I had to make a lot of compromises, and also because it was the first longer piece I ever did.
Yeah, you weren't quite as fleshed out as far
right,
as...
Right, exactly. And now, you know, with a couple more graphic novels under my belt, I feel that, well, now's the time to do it.
Mm-hmm. No, I'd be really interested in reading kind of more in-depth.
Well, I got a lot of stuff I left out, and, of course, a lot of stuff I've discovered since I wrote the book. And, yeah, it's a creepy story.
Have you been kind of contacting your former school...
Oh yeah, we've always been in contact. In fact, we just had a reunion. So I've heard a lot of, you know, different stories and got photos, and actually a buddy of mine, an acquaintance of mine, actually bought Dahmer's house.
Really?
I tried to talk him out of it, but
didn't he live in an apartment when everything went down?
No, that was in Milwaukee.
Okay.
See, here he grew up here, and he killed his first victim in that house.
Oh wow.
And then the majority of his unspeakable crimes are committed in Milwaukee. And that building's gone. It's been torn down.
Yeah. Horrible, horrible stuff. Fascinating, especially by the, I guess, the mimicking kind of pseudo-retarded.
Yeah, he had he would sort of fake epileptic fits and... mimic the slurred speech of his interior decorator, actually his mom's interior decorator, who had cerebral palsy. And we all found this extremely funny.
Yeah.
Which, you know, only 17-year-old teenagers can do. I make no apologies for that. You know, I mean, come on, we were kids, and, you know, we didn't know.
I still do stuff now that would disgust people.
Right. The most common thing I hear, you know, from some people is like, well, you know, why didn't you get him help? Why didn't you kids speak up? And, you know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, 2008. It was 1978.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we didn't even know about substance abuse. That term didn't even exist yet. You know, to us it was just called partying, and everybody did it.
It's like that part in Wayne's World where the guy's just partied too much.
Right.
Sorry for the terrible reference there.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it was just a different mindset. And the one thing you never did was narc on a pal. Never, ever.
No.
So, you know, it's... I find that a lot of people want to judge something that happened, you know, 30 years ago with modern mindset, and it just doesn't work. So you just have to kind of accept that for what it was when you read the book. But
I'll look forward to it.
Well, it's a ways away, but
yeah.
I'm working on it. I'm plugging away on it.
Let's talk a little bit more punk rock.
Okay.
What are some what do you think some seminal punk rock albums to you?
Well, the Ramones' first three albums are really the ones that started it all. There were a couple early ones than that, like, you know, Iggy and the Stooges or New York Dolls. I'm not a big Dolls fan, though I understand they were great live. Their records stink.
Yeah, no, I don't like the Dolls much either.
Yeah.
But apparently, I read this great interview with one of the guys from Suicide talking about how they'd play the same space as the Dolls.
Yeah.
Like in this, like, you know, just weird space, and be in another room, and they'd see all the hot women. You know, see the Dolls. Here are these two guys, one guy with a keyboard, one guy just screaming. And
yeah. The Dolls reunited. They're actually not bad.
Yeah, but there's only, like, two,
there's only
of,
two of them
alive.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, all the others are dead. After that, you know, The Clash. I mean, their first four. Well, I'm really a huge Clash fan, so virtually everything they did, except the last one.
That's the double disc?
No, the last one was Cut the Crap when half the band was gone. Not a good album. But
they were just left with the crap.
Yeah, right. Actually, somebody just gave me a bootleg of the Clash's concert that they played in Akron, which I put in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty happy to get that. It sounds terrible on the bootleg. So, I mean, it's, you know, you have this memory of this being this, you know, sort of searing performance, and I don't know. The boot doesn't sound that great.
No, I doubt they had mini disc recorders or digital recorders at that.
Well, they recorded it from the board.
Oh, really?
So it doesn't sound that bad, but it just, you know, it doesn't capture it, at least my memory of it. So the new live disc they just put out, the Shea Stadium one, does. I mean, that sounds great. Now, yeah. God knows what they did to that in the, you know, in the...
The cleanup.
Right, the production booth, but it sounds just fabulous.
No, I was, got a big soft spot for The Clash, and I was very sad when Joe Strummer passed away.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was a real shocker.
You know, like, out of, you know... I love a lot of punk rock stuff, but he was, like, the one guy who was actually, like, really into what he was doing.
Yeah.
Like, there was, like, actually stuff going behind it. I mean, the Ramones are fun, and I know you've got a big thing for the Ramones, but, I mean,
they were morons. I mean,
They had a routine. They did a routine. It was, like, at a certain point, they became, like, a boys band version of a punk band, where they, you know, they had a stage show that went exactly this way.
Right.
It doesn't seem as electric to me.
Right. Well, no. So I have to say, I never saw a bad show by the Ramones. But yeah, I mean, after the first 4 years, you know, they were pretty much done. And they knew that. I mean, they admit as much. After that, it was just a job to them.
Yeah.
They didn't grow anymore after that. I don't think they had the intellectual capacity to really grow as artists. I mean, they were what they were.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they were proud of that, and God bless them.
Mm-hmm.
But Strummer was, you know, Strummer was more. I mean, he was a big mind, and so was Patti Smith, and so were Devo, for that matter.
Yeah.
So it was a real, you know, it was a real mixed bag. But for just sheer raw power, I mean, you can't beat a Ramones show circa 1977. You know, it was amazing.
Lester Bangs.
Sure.
Did you read a lot of his stuff?
I did. I had a subscription to Cream in the mid-70s, back when I was just a young toad. And I lived out in the boonies, you know, outside of, in a little farm town outside of Akron, which might as well have been Mayberry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was really hard to find, again, before the internet, to find access to anything that was in the counterculture. And somehow someone must have clued me in. I got a subscription to Cream, And immediately, just, you know, Lester Bangs stuff just popped out of there. And it's like, wow, this guy is amazing. And he led me to Iggy, and through Iggy, you know, pretty much everything else. Lou Reed, stuff like that.
MC5.
Yeah, you know, I was never really into the MC5. I mean, their records really sound awful. I mean, I like them now. I mean, you know, they're terrific. But, you know, at the time, you hear those recordings, and you just go, oh, this is mud. And they admit as much. I mean, that they were not helped by their engineer.
No. They did a tour with a different singer while the other guy's dead, but
yeah,
and I heard that was fantastic. Oh yeah, it was Evan Dando, wasn't it, from the Lemonheads?
Yeah, I think it was, actually. I didn't see that. I've seen Wayne Kramer play, but I didn't see the MC5 reunion. Virtually everybody has reunited at one point or another.
I've enjoyed the Stooges stuff that I've heard.
Yeah, no, the Stooges stuff. Sound great. But and I mean, Rocket from the Tombs got back together, and they were fabulous. So, you know, you never know when these reunion tours are gonna be great or when they're just gonna stink, and you know, you just kinda gotta roll the dice.
Well, the Stooges, they got Mike Watt on to
play bass,
so it's like,
well, as long as they got Iggy, they're fine.
Yeah.
And
as long as they haven't been practicing too much,
exactly. So they can't really replicate, you know, the heroin highs they were on.
Now, one thing I was really surprised about was the immediate inclusion of Klaus Nomi.
Mm. Now, that is actually, that's one of the exceptions to the book. That actually did happen. He did play Akron. He did play the bank. And it was a really memorable show. It was just so, in my mind, it was just so quintessentially of that era and of that place, because when you think of punk, you think, well, it's a very doctrinaire. It has to be this. It's a very closed little system. But that wasn't the case at all. I mean, you were pulling in all sorts of music from across the spectrum. It was really kind of the music industry that divided things up.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being a fan. I mean, if it was new, we were into it. So, and Klaus Nomi was definitely fit into that category, and I really urge everyone to go check out the YouTube clips of Nomi, because he's really kind of just, he's indescribable.
I think there's this one when Bowie played
Saturday Night Live. Yeah,
yeah. Klaus did was on stage with them.
Yep. Yeah, Klaus and his boyfriend.
And they carried Bowie on stage in this weird plaster.
Right. Yeah, it was like a big flower pot.
Very memorable. Very easy to YouTube. Tell me about some of the characters in one that really I loved was the schizophrenic guy in the trailer park.
Well, as I said, I grew up in a small town, so yeah. You know, one of the things I wanted to do with this book was divide it up between this punk club, which obviously would be very counterculture, and then this small town where Otto lives. And I like the contrast there, but, you know, there's a lot of similarities, because you get just whack jobs in both places, but they're different kinds of whack jobs. And because I was, my second graphic novel, which is Trashed, is the memoir of my career as a garbage man, which was spent in my hometown. And so I got to know all these bizarre individuals, just kind of wrote them down over the years and just was saving them. And I just threw everything into this book. You know, everything I had in my sketchbook that I hadn't used before, it's in there. And so a lot of the small town stuff was really, I really wanted to get it in. And this guy, the schizophrenic guy who lives in the trailer park, doesn't take his meds. He barks at the neighbors. And at one point he takes his parents hostage. I won't give away what happens, but it doesn't end badly. It's I think, a pretty funny sequence. And, you know, when you live in a small town, you run into people like this all the time. Every town has one, some guy that wigs out, if not three or four guys that wig out, and who live at home until they're 50 and, you know, talk to trees.
The local madman.
Right.
No, one place I used to live in, it's in the middle of the city in Vancouver, in our ghetto neighborhood in the downtown east side, and we had one guy every day at 4:30 would meow.
Cool.
And it was just like, you know, it's the meow hour.
Right, right.
And then in Christmas, or during the winter, you know, before Christmas, every day, I think that same guy would just go and go, Merry fucking Christmas! And then just keep going. I miss that, living in my new gentrified neighborhood.
Oh, well, yeah, you know, the yuppie neighborhoods, they just don't have the color.
No, it's...
They just don't have it.
No, all they have is coffee shops and pedicure.
Well, we don't even have that. We don't have much of anything anymore. Actually, my small town is now all McMansions, so all the yuppies moved in. You know.
That's okay. They're probably all foreclosed.
Bankrupt,
now,
yeah,
too.
I know. There's a lot of foreclosures, yeah.
It's amazing looking at all the stuff that's happening down there, because we're not really feeling it the way it's hitting American.
Right.
You know, it's...
Give it time. You will.
Oh, I live in the Olympic City, so...
Yeah, well, yeah, you may be a little... Vancouver may be a little immune, because that's, yeah. But, man...
No, we're
everybody gonna, else is feeling it, you know. Go to Iceland or...
Iceland's just scary.
Japan or anywhere. I mean, it's just like all of Europe is just one economy crashing after another.
Well, Japan's been crashing for a while, too, I think.
Right, right.
It's,
so we're back in the 70s again, you know. It's a recession again. What a jip.
So oil's all involved, you know, not going well, and...
And, you know, it's, of course, perfect timing on my part that I release a graphic novel just as the economy goes in the toilet. That's sort of a classic career move for me. And, you know, comics are, you know, a lot of the comics publishers are really on the rocks right now, too.
Yeah, no, even I think your publisher, Slave Labor Graphics, a.k.a. Amazing Inc., they're feeling the pinch with the new distributor quotas. And because
yeah, that's a real drag.
They're one of the few that still actually publish, you know, separate comics, don't just
right.
live off the graphic novel market, as people like to call it, which I go, it's just a comic, only longer.
Right. Big-ass comics, I call them.
Yeah, there we go. I'm fine with that.
Right.
So, well, I look forward to your eventual Dahmer, and I very much enjoyed Punk Rock and Trailer Parks.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. It's gotten good reviews, so...
It's
hopefully.
Fun, you know? You know? It's a fun read. And
well, it's a good read. It's just a good yarn. That's what I was... That was my goal going into it, and hopefully I accomplished that. I mean, it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And especially now, we need, you know, comics to lighten the mood, and you can always burn them for heat if times really get tough.
Exactly. And it's not a thin book.
You know? No, it'll burn for a good 10 minutes.
Newsprint, it's good for starting the fire.
That's right.
Please do not burn comics. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today, Durf.
Thanks, Robin.
That was Durf. His book is Punk Rock and Trailer Parks, as well as the ongoing strip in many weekly alternative papers around America called The City. And check him out. I'll post the link on the websites, inkstuds.com, CITR 101.9 FM.